those who are on, let me just welcome you all here on behalf of the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders. If this is your first time on our esophageal digestive motility disorder program, all the more we welcome you, and we welcome all those who have come before. If you do not know me already, my name is Mary Angela DeGrazia Tucci, and I am a longtime patient who suffers from chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudo-obstruction, which over the years progressed to include my digestive tract, my bladder, my biliary system, and like so many other patients, I also have a multitude of non-digestive diseases. And as far as my esophagus is concerned, I have been diagnosed with gastroesophageal reflux, dysphagia, which is difficulty swallowing, diffuse esophageal spasm, which is known as DES, and achalasia. In 1991, I was very privileged to start the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, also known as AGMD. We're a nonprofit international organization that provides education, awareness, and advocacy, and promotes further research in the specialized area of gastroenterology. I'd also like to present to you Laura Schmidt. Laura, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then I'll bring it back.
Okay, my name is Laura Schmidt, and I've had gastroparesis for 14 years, and I'm a type 1 diabetic. And in the process of having gastroparesis for so long, I developed Barrett's esophagus, which we can discuss during the meeting. But I volunteer with the AGMD and try to help out anybody who's going through problems with these issues.
Also want to welcome all of you just to jump in the conversation. If you have something particular you'd like to have addressed, you can bring that up. If you just want to talk about your own experience, that would be great. I ask that you say your first name before you speak, or if you don't want to say your first name, make up a name, that's fine. And that way there we can identify the voice with who's talking. In the event that you just want to listen in, I hope that you do gain something out of this program, and you can actually be at any time if you are on the computer and just say, can you talk about this or I have a question about this, if you don't want to talk. If you are on the internet, I believe you'll be able to send a chat to me and I would be able to see that, I think. A little bit more background on my esophageal involvement. I can recall the very first time I experienced this tremendous pain in my esophagus, and I went into panic mode. I had no idea what this was. I had been in the kitchen. My aunt was visiting from New York. We were having a nice conversation, and it struck me as if it was a heart attack. So this pain in my esophagus was very deep. It was affecting my voice a little bit. The pain was so great that it was radiating down my left arm and into my back and across my jaw. So I excused myself and I went into another room and I just was praying, dear God, what is this? And please let it go away quickly. But it didn't. That same day, my husband was doing a marathon race, and I wanted to go there and see him. So I didn't want to worry anybody, but that pain in my chest and jaw and left arm, and it was excruciating. I was lying down. I lied down for a little bit, but for the rest of the day, I had this pain, but I pretended nothing was wrong, and I still went to see my husband. I still talked with my family, and from that point on, it just became a normal part of my life. I realized after finally I saw this article about this doctor who does esophageal procedures, and I went to see him, and he diagnosed it as diffuse esophageal spasm. So now, again, it had a name. Yippee, wow, that's great, but now what the heck are they going to do with me? And the options at that time were not a lot. Even though now. There are more, but still, one of the medications they wanted to put me on was something for people with high blood pressure and heart problems, and also nitroglycerin. And when I went to fill those prescriptions, my pharmacist, realizing that I have hypoglycemia sometimes, he says, you know what, you better make sure somebody's home with you because you could actually pass out in taking these meds. Of course, that instilled the fear of hell in me, and I ultimately didn't take it. So there the bottle sat because I was afraid. So now you're afraid of this pain that you're getting and when is it going to happen, but then you're also afraid, well, what can I do for it? Eventually, it was diagnosed as achalasia. And the line between them, and there's now so much research going on in that sometimes they have them as two separate identities, but there's an awful lot of overlapping that goes within them. And so what happens to me when that occurs is I can be eating or drinking or doing nothing, and this pain will come immediately. If I am eating or drinking, it blocks off my breathing, and then I end up choking and gagging, and you can feel this spasm so greatly within the esophagus itself. So you end up vomiting, or I end up vomiting, and just trying to gasp for breath so I can get some relief. From that point on, anytime I swallow, the pain is awful, and it's like even swallowing saliva is extraordinarily painful. Through the night, it will inevitably, just about every night, food and liquid will aspirate into my lungs and cut off my breathing. So it's not an unlikely scene in my home to all of a sudden be sleeping and all of a sudden making all these sounds just to get air, and my husband wakes up in a panic. But that's our routine. That's our life. The other thing is that as a result of all of these esophageal problems, because of the reflux as well, my voice will change. So sometimes it yodels. Sometimes I sound like an adolescent boy trying to find his adult voice versus a child voice. And sometimes it turns into a whisper. Sometimes it's so low that I sound like a man. And other times it's a whisper and I just weave in and out of having a voice. And this can last from a moment to minutes to days to weeks. And if it comes back just for maybe a few minutes, suddenly it comes back again. So when I'm eating or drinking, I never know when this is going to happen. But also when I'm out in public, I never know when this is going to happen. So along with all the other motility issues, it's certainly a concern. And but I've learned to handle it in public so nobody knows all of this is going on. And I've learned to kind of make jokes about my voice, even though when my voice is like that, it's extremely painful. But I deal with a lot of difficult situations by adding humor into it. So that's a little bit about my esophageal involvement. I have not had Botox. I have not had a fundoplication. I have not had any surgery done. I've had the dilations or dilations on my esophageal sphincter. But that was years ago. And so now, like so many of us, I just kind of learned to live with it. There are two medications that I take, actually three, and one is Acifex, which was a very, very expensive drug before it came out with a generic form in March. But because it is a new generic, it's still very expensive. And then the other one is just Zantac, and I take copious amounts of these pills because one isn't going to work. And then, of course, I take the Zofran for the nausea and vomiting that I have all the time. So that's it in a nutshell. Laura, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your experience in
Okay, well, I've always had acid, you know, reflux a little bit, acid, but it was never really that bad. Even with gastroparesis, it didn't cause that many problems at the beginning. Then it started to get worse, and with this disease, there's a lot of pain, and I would end up vomiting, and I could not stop, and I'd have to go to the hospital. By the time I get to the hospital, the pain from the gastroparesis and my throat were so bad that they would have to knock me out with painkillers to get everything stopped and to help me out. I went and had an endoscopy and with a really, really renowned GI doctor in Boston, and he took a lot of pictures to show me that now my esophagus from vomiting for all the years that I did, and that's what completely caused my problem, kind of looked like raw hamburg, the inside of my esophagus, instead of a smooth, skin-colored thing. It's very red. It's very sore. If I get everyday life, it doesn't really bother me. But if I get any acid reflux, I can't even explain the pain. Vomiting sometimes because it's so bad. I've almost passed out before. It gets really bad. And the only way that I have to really treat it, there aren't really any treatments. And the only scary thing about it is that they have said that it does try to heal itself. It will try and regrow skin back on and, you know, smooth it out. But a lot of times that turns to cancer because the body's not supposed to do that. It's something it's not normally doing. So I just have to keep an eye on it. One way that I can treat it that helps a lot, especially if I'm vomiting at home, I get a mixture. It's almost like Maalox with lidocaine in it, which is a numbing agent they use, and I gargle with it, and that will numb my throat, and then swallow it very slowly, and it will numb up my throat so that I can at least drink or eat or do whatever I was trying to do. And it'll help for a while. A lot of times, bad days, I have to do it a lot. But it is something that does help control it. It does keep the pain down. But it's not something that's really going to go away very fast on its own. May someday, but I have to wait. I have to wait for that. So I just deal with it, and I try to not eat acidy foods. And I, you know when I'm going to be sick from my gastroparesis, I make sure I have a bottle of that with me wherever I am of the lidocaine mix so that I can bear the pain in my throat, you know. But it was caused by all the stomach acid, actually, that went through there. You know, vomiting is one thing, but when it sits in your stomach for 4 days of food, the acid and stuff really builds up, and then that's what had caused my Barrett's esophagus.
And you love coffee, Laura.
I do.
See?
I love coffee.
And what does coffee do?
Well, it's actually warm, so it doesn't hurt as much.
Yes, but it does have that acid in it. One registered dietitian was saying that, I believe it was Dunkin' Donuts, is one of the worst with the value of it, but I don't know if that's just something she has said. What amazes me is how all of us tend to kind of integrate it into our life at one point and learn to live with it. And the amazing part is not only that we have the endurance to do that, but also how much the body can take. That to me is phenomenal. My God, it's the way, leave the machine alone and watch what it does, because it really can adapt to so many things. But as far as reflux is concerned, there are some outside the medical realm things that have been brought to my attention. And one of them is putting either your bed on blocks so that the head part is elevated. They have all sorts of different wedge pillows. One is MediWedge. Another one is like an inflatable one. They have tons of them. I actually bought, or my husband bought, a Sleep Number bed because we had a Tempur-Pedic and this is not a sales pitch by any measure of it, but I had we had a Tempur-Pedic, and we found, well, especially me, that even though it was an electronic Tempur-Pedic, that I would sink down, and it felt like I was in quick, I'm only like 78 pounds, so it's not like I weigh a lot, but every time I would get out of bed, I felt like I was getting out of quicksand because my body would just sink into the Tempur-Pedic memory foam. So then we opted just this year to get the number bed, and that Sleep Number bed is electronic as well. And that helps to take some pressure off because that the feet and head go. But it helps for the reflux in some degree. My problem is that I like to sleep best on my stomach, which is the worst thing you can do. But that is another option that people use to help. Something else that was very interesting, and I have had some patients that say, oh my God, this has made such a huge difference, along with dietary changes. And that is a type of massage that you do at the base of the esophagus. There's one that you do for constipation, and then there's another that you do, a different technique that you use for reflux. And we have this girl who comes to the Massachusetts group, and actually she got this from her holistic practitioner and chiropractic therapist. And she has demonstrated that. She even demonstrated it during one of our symposiums. And so many patients have tried that, and it has, I mean, really, I have heard that it has worked for them. Unfortunately, like so many things, what works for one may not work for another. In my case, it doesn't work, but it's certainly an option I want to toss out. We have some more people who have joined us online. Welcome. I'm Mary Angela. We have Laura here. We have some other people who are being quiet. If you would like to join in the conversation, you can just say your first name and hop in.
Hi, I'm Angela Van Zandt, and I'm in Little Rock.
Hi,
Angela.
Hi.
So what brings you here today?
Well, I have a motility disorder of the esophagus, and I am probably going back to Johns Hopkins real soon to see what they can do. Maybe get the magnet procedure. That's what I wanted to know, if anyone has done that. The new procedure, I don't know. Oh, it's called Lynx. Yeah, Lynx.
Okay.
Has anyone done that?
We're getting
put a magnet around it.
We're getting an awful lot of inquiries about patients who are contemplating having that done and haven't had it done yet. Does anybody on this program, have they had that done? No. We have quite a few people on the program, but a lot of them have chosen not to talk, and they just want to listen in. So I may get an email from one of them, and they may tell me. And if that's the case, Angela, I'll certainly share it with you.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit more about your motility problem.
It started literally overnight. I woke up one day with it when I was 23. It's a long time ago, and it never left. Plus, I had pain, horrible pain, and I finally got rid of the stomach pain with Cymbalta. I went to a pain clinic at Cleveland Clinic, and well, I went to the gastro people first, and they sent me to the pain clinic, and with the first pill, that pain went away, and they said, you'll be on it the rest of your life. But I took it for 2.5 years, and I decided to get off. They said, we're giving you this not because you're depressed. We know you're a happy person, which I am. But they said, we think you have some kind of pain syndrome, and Cymbalta takes care of that. Well, with the first pain pill, it went away. Then after 2.5 years, I decided to get off, and they had said it would come back, but it didn't. So this tells me that there was something in my stomach that the nerves that this pill rerouted. Maybe two nerves were touching, I don't know. But I had something like shingles inside a few months before this happened, before my first, you know, before it first started hurting. So now they're thinking maybe this infection caused all this.
Oh.
But it's been a lifelong problem, and it seems to be getting worse. Now you can hear my voice.
Yes.
And I have edema of the larynx now because of it. Mm-hmm. And I've been aspirating in my lungs. And I had a seizure a year ago that they thought I had epilepsy because it was a terrible seizure. And they put me on Keppra. It's a seizure medication. I couldn't drive for almost a year until I went to Johns Hopkins. And I said, look, I just don't think I'm an epileptic. And we went through a long visit, and she looked at my EEG, and she says, you're not. You do not have epilepsy. She said, I don't know why you had that episode, but it was more like a convulsion. I just quit breathing and went into a seizure. Another complication of that night is that I had a gas leak in this house, and I did not know it. I might not ever know what happened to me that night, but I know that I have this edema of the larynx and aspiration. I've been to a lung doctor now, and he suggested I have the Nissen. Well, I don't want to do that if the magnet thing works as well, because it's less invasive.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to try that, even as just before I do the big surgery, I'm going to try that if I can, and see if it works. But when your larynx swells up as much as mine does, it's not good because it can cut off your air supply.
Mhm. Well, I understand. I understand so much of what you said there. I think you came on later. You missed the beginning when I was saying how I experienced the aspiration into my lungs happens just about every day. My voice is impacted. In fact, I'm a musician by nature. Trained musician, and as a result of all of that, I was singing, and I've lost the ability to sing. And my voice, like yours, weaves in and out. Sometimes it disappears. So all of that I get, and the pain. But now, what diagnosis have they given you, or diagnoses have they given you regarding all of this, except for that pain syndrome?
Oh, okay. That it's one's a symptom, I guess, but the cause is the reflux. But the reflux, I think, was caused because the nerve endings what makes your muscles move, you know, were altered or destroyed during that infection a long time ago. So now I'm having to deal with that. But they said I had reflux and motility disorder of the esophagus. But it's probably of the whole, you know, all the way down to the bottom of my stomach, probably, not just the esophagus.
When you get that pain in your esophagus, because, again, we share a lot in common here, and I'm sure some of our other participants but when you get that, do you get this pain that is very, very deep within your esophagus? It radiates to your arm, can radiate to your back?
No.
Okay.
No, it's localized. It's just, it used to be my stomach, but that pill, that Cymbalta, took care of that. It's just my throat, and it's only for liquids. When I went to Johns Hopkins in 2000, when they diagnosed it as a motility disorder, they said it's just for liquids. Now, my food goes down, but if I drink even a glass of water, this is a good test, ice water, iced tea, something like that on a cold, a hot day, a really cold drink, you can feel the cold coming back. You know, as it comes back up, it's cold. So whatever I drink, you know, comes back up. So, you know, one reason I know they were right about that. But I just don't know what to do, because if they do that, you know, the magnet thing, it seems to be a mechanical problem. I keep thinking of my sink in the kitchen, you know, under the kitchen sink. You know, if you tie that off, and one time a surgeon here was going to do some kind of surgery, like the I guess it was going to be like the Neeson, and a surgeon was going to do that for me, and then my gastroenterologist heard about it, and he called me the night before and talked me out of the surgery. He says, if you tie that off, it'll make you even worse. He said, you'll never be the same. Please don't do it. And they got into a fight, sort of, the two doctors, because I went to the surgeon without telling my gastroenterologist about it. I just did it. And he found out about it and called me at home, like the night before the surgery, the next day. So they can't even decide, you know, agree on what to do. And I think there are some people that are just different from everyone else, their case, to the point that doctors can't even agree. And when you live in a smaller place, or not that Little Rock is small, it isn't, but you know, I might be the only person in the state with something like this. This is why I think it's important to go to the bigger centers like Mayo, Johns Hopkins, Cleveland, where they have seen the odd cases. And I tried to get into Mayo recently, and they wouldn't take me. And I don't know if it's because they didn't think they could help, or because they were too busy, or too many people trying to see them. But I already have, you know, a track record at Johns Hopkins, so I'm going back there. And from what I can tell, they might be better at motility anyway than Mayo. Not that, you know, that there's anything wrong with Mayo. But I will say this, Cleveland Clinic, bless them, they that pain was for 33 years nonstop. I'm talking 24/7. It was on a scale of 1 to 10. It was at 8 all day, all night. And I went ahead and lived my life, and they told me, they said, most people would be on disability. How did you stand this? And I just did it. You just do it. And I remember working in a job one time, like very stressful job, 14 hours a day in a newspaper. And we were in a newspaper war with the other newspaper, and it was we ended up in federal court for antitrust. So it was not an easy job. And I remember just going around during the day, just hitting myself in the stomach, because if I hit myself in the stomach, on the outside, it took the pain away from the inside. That's how desperate you get. But you, what else can you do? But it's been just horrible. But if anyone has that pain that you just cannot live with, seriously, Cymbalta did something. I don't know. And I can't understand why it didn't come back. But it didn't. But I am stuck with some of the pain in the esophagus, and just with the, you know, just with what it's doing to my larynx.
Is that a constant pain, or is it unpredictable pain?
Well, right now it's somewhat both. I mean, it's always there, like on a scale of 1, but it can get up there to like a 5. but it doesn't get up there to an, like the stomach did. The stomach was unbearable, but this is more bearable. This is more like right now, I don't know. I call it a cheerleader voice. It's like you've been yelling at a football game or something. But it's, you know, like a hoarseness.
Yes. Well, let me just talk about a few things on there. And, again, if anybody who is on the call who wants to jump in, please just do. You can call out my name, or you can Mary Angela, or you can call Laura's name, and we'll get you in. But I just want to talk about a few things that you said. And had a lot there, and I'm just so sorry that you are going through all of this suffering for so many years. But you're a smart lady, I can tell, and your ability to search for the right place for you is critically important. And one of those things is, look, the field of gastroenterology is a generalized field. So a doctor will get his degree, and then he'll specialize in gastroenterology, if that's what he chooses or she chooses to do. If they want to do motility, then they do further training for digestive motility disorders, and then some will continue on in subspecialty in, for example, the esophagus or the stomach. But you also have some that are both. And going to a hospital or to a doctor, but I'm just going to focus on the hospital now, which is a big institution instead of a local hospital. The benefit of that, as you had said, is that they see more patients. They also see more patients with motility. And there potentially could be research going on there. So it's not like you're the only patient that they're seeing that may have some similar forces going on, but that there are quite a few that they're seeing, depending on the doctor and the motility specialty that they're going to be seeing. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that with digestive motility, it's still pioneer territory. And for those of you who are on the call and have been on these calls for a while, I know you can probably say the exact words I'm going to say, but it's a pioneer territory because they're still learning so much about how the digestive tract works. And it is controlled by so many systems within the body. And one of those is the enteric system. So that's the signal from the brain to the spine, actually, and the neurotransmitters. Another is the sympathetic, parasympathetic system within your body. Another is hormonal. That's a lot of women, when they get their periods, they find that there's an exacerbation of their symptoms, and potentially it's because of the hormonal element. But there are other reasons. And then if you get a virus, they're doing, depending on the type of motility problem you have and also how it evolved, it can potentially start from some sort of a virus. As my doctor said in my case, I probably had it in me my whole life, but it took strep throat, mononucleosis, the flu, all of these other things to keep igniting it, and then eventually that last code must have just made it erupt, and then it never went away. So it may just be in your body for whatever reason, be it a genetic, but also being a viral cause. So that's the second thing. When people talk about pain, I read an article by a physician, actually, and it was really an excellent article in that they said when a patient goes to the doctor and the doctor asks, all right, so describe your pain on a scale 1 to 10. And that's the standard pain scale. Excuse me. Everybody's tolerance is different, and it sounds like you have a very, very high tolerance. I know Laura does. I do. And so when you say, well, it's a pain level of an 8 or a pain level of a 10, and you may not even look like you're in that distress, but but maybe you're in control of yourself in the doctor setting. I don't know, whatever the case may be. It's such a vague way to describe it. So this doctor has said it's a much clearer picture if not only you point to the area, if you can, and use descriptive words like what type of pain that you get. Is it acute? Is it chronic? Is it sharp? Is it an ache? But if you think about what is the worst pain you've ever felt in your life, like bang your hand with a hammer, whatever that is, and then you say, it feels like it felt in my life when this particular thing happened, they'll get a better idea of the level. And so just another little tip to throw out there. The other thing, as far as your question about that procedure, are you on our AGMD online Inspire site at all?
What did you say? I'm sorry.
Are you on our AGMD Inspire online site at all?
Yes. Sometimes I'm on there reading the articles. Yeah.
Okay. And that's one that you join. You can pose questions. You can have a discussion. You can post your journal, whatever you want to do. But it may be a great thing for you to just ask, has anybody had that procedure done? And if so, what were the results in their particular case? And the great thing, too, is that you have people from all around the world who, if they have or are considering it, will respond. So that's a great forum for you to pose your question. We also put out a publication called the Search and Research Publication, at least for this year. And you can always just submit the question to me, and I'll be sure that we get it into the next issue. And if anybody gets that, and that's done to the whole membership, then they can respond with an email or a regular note telling me, yes, this is what it is. And I can even put you in connection with that person, if they're willing. So when is your appointment there?
Well, right now I have to get all of my new medical records to the new doctors scanned and sent to the girl that sets up the appointments. So that's my problem, is I have all my medical records with me, but I have to scan them and I have to find the time to do that. So it will probably be after Christmas that I would actually get to go. And I don't know if it was on your site or where I read this, and this might not be something that would work. It might, I don't know, but there is a stent that they're using on your the lower part of your stomach, the pylorus,
mm-hmm.
and they're opening up stent with a stent in the event that someone has gastroparesis. Now, I have not been diagnosed with that, but I wonder, you know, about that stent and if some of this problem for some people, the reflux could be from the lower part of the stomach, if that would work.
Well, that's what I was thinking about, too, at the beginning. Was that some patients with gastroparesis also have reflux. And I might want to add that a lot of people say, well, I don't have reflux because I don't feel the acid.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a type of reflux called NERD, of all things, N-E-R-D, and that's non-erosive reflux disorder. So you can still have reflux and not realize it.
When you say non-erosive, you mean it is not acid.
Yeah, you don't feel the symptoms. You're not going to feel the burning and everything, but the motility in there is still not working right.
Oh, okay. Well, I know when I lived in Atlanta, one time at Emory, I've been everywhere, honestly, Emory, Dr. Patrick Waring, he did this study where you swallow a magnet or something, and it it measures it, the acid. It was called the Bravo test.
Yep, and the pH Bravo test.
Yep. Yeah, the Bravo. So I was supposed to write down a journal. Of course, you know, I thought I was on fire every other minute and wrote down, oh, it's terrible, you know, in my pain. And then I went back to see him. He goes, well, this is funny because you don't have any acid. You don't have acid.
Mm.
So that was very odd to me, and I felt very strange because I thought, well, does he believe me? Does he think I'm crazy? What is this? You know, but believe me, the last thing I want is poor health. I'm not a hypochondriac. I'm the opposite of that. And I will say that I had Wolf Parkinson White syndrome in my heart when I was a child, born with it. I finally got that fixed when I was 36 with surgery. But that is an arrhythmia, and it has something to do with your electrical system in your heart. And it was real bad case. I had like 12 Kent bundles, and most people have the disease have one. So my heart was like a turbo engine on a Volvo. I mean, they had to go in and cut that out. I had like 12 extra conduction systems in my heart that you were not born with. Now, my gastro doctor now in this town said he thinks that my motility disorder is somehow a birth defect, just like my heart was. He said, your whole electrical system is just messed up. And I made a joke, and I said, well, I guess I'm lucky I don't have epilepsy. He said, you sure are. Well, 6 months later was when I had that seizure, and when they thought I had epilepsy, but thank goodness I don't. But I'm just wondering if all of us have some kind of electrical issue. You know, it's like, this is just too strange that my heart and my stomach and my esophagus would have, you know, these issues. And but I don't think I have epilepsy. I really don't. I think that the aspiration caused that convulsion, and I think that's pretty much been established. Because I will say that Johns Hopkins at the time in July, they were number one in neurology. So I went there. So I talked to one of the top doctors in neurology in the country. So I feel confident that I don't have epilepsy because I haven't had any more of those. Of course, I could, you know, if it were the other. But the way she described it to me, I was awake. I was talking. You don't do that with an epileptic seizure. I was very aware.
Yes.
And it went on for a long, long time, but I was talking. But my muscles were totally out of control. But from what I understand, if you aspirate enough, it's almost like drowning. And when people drown, I've heard of stories of people drowning, and they just have these big spasms of their arms and legs. They, you know, it's hard to rescue them because they're thrashing. That's what I was doing.
Wow.
Awful, like drowning in your sleep. I mean, I was asleep when it happened, and I just woke up and started all of that. But I really think it's because I couldn't get any air. And I told the neurologist that here. I said, listen, I just couldn't breathe. And it was like someone put a pillow over my head, then I just started, you know, moving like that. And he said, oh, that breathing thing, that's unrelated to your seizure. I said, well, it was 30 seconds before, or 1 second before. He said it was coincidence.
Nah, I'll see. it's so frustrating because so many of us have all of these other symptoms, and we're the ones who are trying to link everything together. There certainly is some sort of a disconnect with the nerve signals within our body, which also the muscles. Laura, have you had the Bravo test? Laura, are you still there?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, I'm here, and no, I have not.
You haven't?
No.
So how did they determine your reflux and esophageal problem? Was that through an endoscopy?
Yep, through endoscopies, many of them.
Yeah, and explain to her a little bit more about yourself, Laura, because she came on a little bit late, yeah. And we had a couple of others came on late.
Okay, well, my name is Laura, and I've been a type 1 diabetic 36 years. I've had gastroparesis for 14 years, and due to the gastroparesis and the enormous amount of vomiting I did, during the time I did get reflux because gastroparesis holds so much food in your stomach that the acid started to come up a little, but it really wasn't a huge deal. And then after years and years and years of so much vomiting, my throat got to the point where my whole throat just hurt so bad. It was almost immobilizing. And I had another endoscopy, and I was diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus, which is basically the lining of your esophagus rots away. The acid from the vomiting rotted all the way. So now it looks like raw hamburg in there. It will try to heal itself, and if I'm lucky, it'll grow, you know, it might grow over, be fine. I have to keep having endoscopies, though, because it's a precursor to cancer. A lot of people, when it heals, it causes throat cancer. But I'm not so much worried about that because I think it is healing. But it has been one of the horrible things. If I get sick or anything like that, the acid, it burns so bad. And I carry around with me a mix of, it's no name stuff, but it's like Maalox and lidocaine, which is a numbing agent. I have to gurgle with it just to be able to stand the pain from the Barrett's. Fortunately, things have been better, and I haven't been vomiting as much lately. So I think it's helping a little. It hasn't hurt too much as of late. But I'm hoping that that'll heal itself without cancer.
Now, Laura, you've never been to the Mayo or Cleveland, right?
No, just some of the Boston hospitals.
Have you tried, have they given you something called Carafate? It's a pink liquid. It might be better than what you're using at Maalox. It's for reflux. It's a thin pink liquid.
No, they haven't given it to me, but it's worth a try. I've heard of it.
Carafate.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion. I know I've heard some people who have had ulcers, and they have given that as well. But they used to give it out a lot more, and I don't know if there's a box warning on it. But those particular people that I know that take it have found it to be very, very helpful. So that's a good suggestion. So if it gets worse, Laura.
Yep. I will definitely try it.
Something, yeah. Carafate. It's, excellent. We will also, go ahead.
I was going to say that's a prescription. You'll have to ask your doctor.
No, bro, that's no problem. She'd do anything to help me.
Some of the other things, we were suggesting some things that could potentially be beneficial for patients. And it was outside the medical realm because we have to do what we can to try to help ourselves. I know a lot of people actually try vinegar, cider vinegar, and they find that that helps with their reflux, which to me is contrary because it's so acidic, but they find that it works. But another thing was the elevated bed, and you just elevate with blocks or books the legs of the head part of your bed. Another one is, of course, the electronic bed, which can help. They have all sorts of pillows, wedge pillows. One somebody just introduced me to was the Medi Wedge pillow, and it comes in different sizes and shapes. Another one is like an air pillow that somebody just introduced me to as well. And then I was telling the people on this call that there is also a massage that you can do for yourself to yourself. And so many patients with reflux have found that to be helpful. Again, like everything else, what works for one may not work for another, but this particular treatment was introduced to me by someone who had gone to a holistic practitioner, and this girl has introduced it and demonstrated it in so many of our programs because it has been so helpful to quite a few people now. So those are just some outside-of-the-box suggestions that have worked for people. I don't know.
I have one question. I've been trying to research this. Does anyone know anything about stem cell research for what we have? I know that Johns Hopkins and Mayo both have a big building for stem cell research, and I've been reading things about it for all kinds of things, for people with spinal cord injuries and, you know, all of that. But there was a child born in this town without an esophagus, and they grew, a trachea. She was born without a trachea, and they grew one for her from her own stem cells. And, of course, she was a growing child, so she wasn't an adult, so that might have made a difference. But I wonder if there's any, like for Laura, for your Barrett's, if there's anyone doing anything with stem cells where you could just grow new cells for damaged cells, and if this motility issue is from damaged nerve endings, in my case it probably was from the virus, I'm wondering the future in taking care of these problems, if we could just grow new tissue from our own stem cells. And, I mean, I know that those two places have the research, but has anyone read anything about it for esophaguses? Is that the way you say that?
Esophagus. Esophagy, I don't know.
I mean, we only have one, but...
I know, I've never thought about the plural, but we can make it up. That sounds
okay,
fine.
Okay, our esophaguses, well, I'm a writer. I should know better, but, hey, I'm a Southerner. I can make a mistake. But anyway, I don't know, about that myself. I mean, I haven't been able to find anything specifically for GI, but I think that's real exciting. So I don't want anyone to give up because they are literally, you know, doing these things that come out of a science fiction movie. So, you know, maybe there's hope, Laura.
Oh, absolutely.
I will tell you that during our symposium, I had a pediatric GI doctor at Mass General. He was one of our speakers. And it's such a privilege to have him. And his whole presentation was about stem cell research and the research that their lab was doing, but stem cell in general regarding motility disorders. And I just couldn't believe that this was happening because when stem cell research started hitting the news, I was making probes to some of the doctors. But it has really advanced, and I know at the 2015 Digestive Disease Week, they're going to be doing presentation on, they call it enteric neurobiology, cell and molecular biology, and they're going to be explaining about some of the research that they're doing. So it is being done, specifically on the esophagus. I'm not quite sure, but I'm sure we can find out because it's really big in research right now.
That's wonderful. Now, what hospital is doing this research?
Well, I got the information. Our organization belongs to the American Neurogastroenterology and Motility Society, which is a professional organization for those in the motility field. But also, I think the American Gastroenterology Association has something about it.
Okay.
But if I think that if you, let me just take a peek here and see. Yeah, the enteric, there's a lot of research being done on that enteric system. You know, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I think it's important to go to a neurogastro doctor if you have a motility disorder rather than just a gastro doctor that deals with, you know, colon problems and things. The neurogastro people, because if motility disorders, aren't they somewhat neurological when you think about it? I mean, it's nerves, nerve endings.
Yeah.
That are not working. So that's one thing that it took me forever to figure out, that I was going to the wrong kind of doctor, the wrong kind of gastro doctor.
Mm-hmm. And that's
it's just
yep.
Well, it's just like with my heart. You can go to a cardiologist, but if you have an arrhythmia, you need to go to a cardiologist that deals with a pacing, you know, with how fast your heart beats, you know, with arrhythmias, and it's totally different system. And there are more people that die from arrhythmias than from regular heart attacks, you know, with vascular problems and stuff. So it's sort of the same analogy. But I finally, with my heart, finally ended up at Montefiore in New York at a arrhythmia center. We didn't have an arrhythmia center here. So one thing I've learned about my body is that I have an electrical issue. Almost everything is electrical. And finding those electrical doctors has been difficult, but I finally figured that out. But the neurogastro doctors are rare.
Yes. Well, you'll find them at some of the motility centers, and that's hopefully and prayerfully we're getting more, but it's still a very specialized area. You have brought up some excellent points, and Laura, I also thank you for your input. If you have any questions or you want to continue the discussion, you can always just email or call me. I hope that you will keep me posted on what is going on with you, and I just think we're running out of time. So let me just ask right out there, is there anybody else who wants to join in the conversation, make a comment, have a question before we wrap it up? We only have 1 minute, and then we'll just get cut off, and I want to make sure we don't do that. No. Okay. So please do continue to keep in touch. My email address is digestive.motility@gmail.com, and the phone number is 781-275-1300. I close these programs always the same way. So I just can't say enough about how everybody who is going through this, you are all my personal hero. I always get such inspiration out of all of you, even through your struggles. And I take each and every one, whether I have talked to you, I've met you, I've never met you, I've emailed, never emailed, no matter what, you are a big part of my life, and you are the force behind this organization. It's all about you. It is your organization. And I am just, it's such an honor to be able to be in this position and meet so many inspirational people who are the quiet heroes among us. I hope that you can have as good a day as you possibly can. And with that, thank you all, and may God bless you all.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.